So Moholy, through his art exhibitions at Storm, caught the eyes of Walter Gropius, who was looking to change the direction of the Bauhaus from an art school to more of a design school. My name is Daniel Hook. I'm the second grandchild of László Moholy Nagy.
The thing that's interesting about Moholy is that he had kind of a singular idea of transparency and light. And then I think what he was doing is he was applying this concept into different media. My name is Andreas Hug. I am the eldest grandson of László Moholy Nagy.
He felt that artists had a responsibility to appropriate technologies, to learn how to use them, and to make art with them in order to humanize them for the general public. My name is Dr. Oliver Botar. I'm Associate Director of the School of Art at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg in Canada.
My name is Anja Guttenberger, and this is my podcast, Bauhaus Faces. Welcome back to a new episode of Bauhaus Faces. Today, we turn to a Bauhaus master, whom I have already mentioned many times before on Bauhaus Faces, especially in episodes about photography, László Moholy Nagy. Or should I say Moholy or Moholy Nagy? His birth name was actually László Weiss. His grandsons, Andreas and Daniel Hook, explained to me that the name Moholy Nagy was connected to the surname of his mother's brother, with whom the family lived after Moholy's father had left them. Later, in Germany, where he moved in his 20s, he was often called Moholy Nagy, partly because the Hungarian pronunciation of Nagy is difficult for German speakers. The family today often simply calls him Moholy, so if you hear different versions of his name in this episode, this is why. For a long time, I personally associated Moholy most strongly with photography and more specifically with the New Vision. He influenced many Bauhaus students who later became important photographers themselves, and so I tended to see him mainly through that lens. But my perspective changed completely after speaking with Daniel and Andreas and with the Canadian art historian Oliver Botar. Daniel is the artistic director of Art Cologne Art Fair in Germany. His brother Andreas is a user experience designer and studied at the Institute of Design in Chicago, the successor institution of the New Bauhaus, which László Moholy Nagy founded after emigrating to the US. So, in a way, both grandsons are still connected to Moholy's legacy from different directions, through art, design, education, and the question of how people engage with visual culture and modern systems today. Through these conversations, I began to understand that Moholy was much more than a brilliant and playful photographer. He was one of the first multimedia artists of the 20th century, working with painting, photography, film, typography, sculpture, and stage design. And yet, perhaps the most important key to Moholy is education. He did not see art as something separate from life. His work tried to mediate between new technology and human experience. That is the Moholy I would like to explore in this episode. Not only the artist of the New Vision, but the educator who asked how we might learn to see, think, and live differently in a technological age. Moholy died young, at the age of only 51, but the body of work he left behind is vast and extraordinarily varied. That is why I decided to tell this story in two parts. The first part focuses on his family background, his path toward becoming an artist, his Bauhaus years, and his later period in Berlin. The second part will follow him to the Netherlands, England, and finally Chicago, where he became director of the New Bauhaus. There will also be a bonus episode for you in which my three interview partners discussed selected works by Moholy. Together, these works show the development from a young, self-taught painter to an internationally renowned artist and educator. Before we begin, just a quick reminder. If you enjoy listening to Bauhaus Faces, please subscribe to the podcast on Spotify, YouTube, or Apple Podcasts. Give it a 5-star rating, a thumbs up, and recommend the podcast to friends, colleagues, and family. And if you would like to support this independent project, you can now do so via Ko-fi on the podcast website bauhausfaces.com. Every form of support, financial or moral, is deeply appreciated. Thank you for being here. Let's now dive into a new episode of Bauhaus Faces and shine a light on Laszlo Moholy-Nagy.
Moholy was born in 1895 in, I might say it wrong, Bakszborsod, which at that time was in Hungary. Today it's in the northern part of Serbia. And he was born to a well-to-do reformed Jewish family, meaning that they went to temple on Sunday, not on Saturday. They didn't dress any differently. They didn't, you know, have the locks or wear kippahs out and about, except when going to temple. The family has kind of a complicated history, but his mother, Rosalind Stern, married the father, Lippot Weiss, and I think in total, they had about five children. Early in Moholy's life, the father disappeared. Family lore was that he went to the U.S., which was what a lot of people did back then. It's questionable. It seems that he just moved to the neighboring town and started a new family. But for whatever reasons, Moholy's mother ended up moving in with her brother, Gustav. And Gustav had already Hungarianized or Magyarized his surname to being Nagy, which is a very common Hungarian name. And he was a lawyer, and he had an extensive collection of art books, Old Masters, Rembrandt, etc., which fascinated Moholy. So that was really his introduction to art. Moholy must have had a very close relationship with his uncle because Moholy eventually, with his older brother Jene and younger brother Akos, took on the surname Nagy, probably in their later teens. So Moholy wanted to become a poet, actually, in the beginning. And then with the outbreak of World War I, he was enlisted and was a junior artillery officer. And it's kind of a funny and sad story. Well, they bought him a horse. So, I mean, they must have been somewhat well off. And he was studying law at the time when World War I broke out. And his mother encouraged him to join the artillery because it was behind the lines, behind the front. Little did he know that it's the junior officers on horses that have to ride up to the front to see where the bombs are actually landing. So it did put him in direct harm's way. But on one of the occasions where he was in the trenches and he pulled himself up to the periscope while reaching up in the trench, his left hand was struck by a bullet or shrapnel, and he was sent to a hospital. And he had a very long convalescence, almost a year, which leads experts to believe that he had some kind of an infection, that it wasn't just a mere bullet wound, but that it became a serious matter. While he was convalescing, he had come to the conclusion that he wanted to become an artist. And he actually wrote in his diary that he felt he could offer more to the world as an artist. And I think it was also this sort of life and death experience that pushed him into taking a more, let's say, for the lack of a better word, selfish idea to dedicate his life to becoming a visual artist.
I think like many of Moholy's contemporaries, World War I was a complete shocker. I think it was a shock from a technological perspective. It was a shock from a cultural and societal perspective in the sense that there was so much bloodshed. And I think with that, it produced a type of desire for utopian existence after the war. An idea of no more war, but utilizing the technology that had been fine-tuned during the war years for a greater good. And when I say technology, I'm thinking of photography, aerial photography especially. I'm thinking about greater capabilities in terms of communication. And so when you have this kind of rebirth after the horrors of World War I, and you're seeing this introduction of all of these new art movements, I think it was interesting for Moholy, who had obviously convalesced during the last part of the war after being shot. I think it was only a natural progression for him to seek out these new utopian visions that were really interested in kind of resetting and redefining the cultural zeitgeist of the area. And I think that led to him taking night classes in painting and drawing. It led to him realizing that he needed to start moving west, ultimately ending up in Berlin, as we all know. But that along this journey, he was able to strike and meet with various organizations such as MA, the Constructivist Organization and Art Group, and then ultimately, of course, the Bauhaus. And I think during this time period, his interest in painting grew out of the fact that it was, to some degree, what a lot of his contemporaries were doing. And it seemed like the medium of expression. And then ultimately, of course, he discovered photography.
He really took a very fresh attitude towards art. He never really studied art. He took some drawing lessons in the evening in Budapest in 1918-19 from a very good teacher, but he studied law. So he came to art as a complete outsider. Now, he was interested in art, but his first love was literature. So this is what he was more interested in when he was younger. But it's interesting that when he had the chance to take photographs during the First World War, he chose to draw. When, for example, André Kertész was keeping a photographic diary of what he was experiencing in the Austro-Hungarian army, and there were all kinds of photographic competitions launched by Budapest illustrated magazines for soldiers, Moholy Nagy decided he wanted to draw, so he drew. He drew on Feldpostkarte, so on official military postcards, and sent those to his best friend and his godfather, Ivan Hevesi. He was the godfather when Moholy Nagy converted from Judaism to Calvinism, to Reformed Church. And Ivan Hevesi was very interested in media. He had already, before the First World War, complained that films were adopting the aesthetics of theater rather than developing the aesthetics that would be commensurate with the technical possibilities of the film medium. So he came from a very interesting intellectual milieu, both in Szeged, where he went to high school, and also in Budapest.
So from Budapest, he went to Vienna, which was the cultural capital of Austro-Hungary in 1919. He didn't stay long. He was rather disappointed with Vienna and felt it to be quite constricting and sort of stuck in its time and moved on to Berlin in 1920.
On one hand, I think it is the excitement of being in a larger metropolis, because I think that you'll see a greater variety in terms of socioeconomic diversity, racial diversity. But you'll also see a diversity of ideas. And I think that's what cities are really famous for. And they've always been. And I think that's the same that was true, especially in Europe during this time. Paris, after World War I, wasn't nearly as popular as Berlin. And so going to Berlin seemed like a natural recourse. I think the thing that really motivated Moholy was the fact that he recognized that where he was in Hungary and where he was prior to moving to Berlin was never going to really help him career-wise. In order to become an artist of the caliber that he wanted to be, he needed to surround himself with people that knew more than him. And the people that knew more than him were in Berlin.
A lot came together in Berlin. And I think he really strongly identified with Berlin, the metropolis, the city. It must have been a very exciting time during the Weimar Republic. I think also, you know, liberally, socially, culturally, it was probably the most advanced place on earth.
By the time he got to Berlin, you know, he was primed to really rethink art. And by that time, he decided to become an artist. And then he encounters the Dadas. He arrives in 1920, and Berlin is the center of Dada, and it's partly, you know, the Malik Verlag circle, Hartfield, etc., Gauss, but also Schwitters, who they hated, was showing at Walden's Der Sturm. And we have a letter from Moholy Nagy to Ivan Hevesi, his godfather, saying, "This Schwitters, I don't know what he wants to do. The Cubists already did this years ago. It's awful." It elicited a crisis in him, a kind of crisis of aesthetics and a crisis of perception. And I think that all these inputs, encountering the Russian constructivists, and then meeting Lucia Schulz, who was steeped in the Freie Deutsche Jugend and in the whole biocentric way of thinking about the world, meeting her, this brilliant young woman, all these things came together. But the point here is that the way he perceived all this was not the way a person who had gone through art academy would perceive it. He perceived it as an outsider. So it was this fresh look at the possibilities of art.
And you can see the shift in Berlin. So in 1920, he goes through about four different styles of geometric abstraction, a short Dadaist period, and then his sort of glass architecture series. It's really pretty hard to date everything because it happens so rapidly. I mean, you get a sense that his work changed, I would say, on a monthly basis. In 1921, there's a nickel sculpture, Nickel Skulptur mit Spiral. That's owned by MoMA. But when this was produced, it shook the ground. People were shocked. This took sculpture and sent it in a new direction. It looks like a machine. And then the whole thing is nickel plated. So this is taking an industrial process and encoding the sculpture in this industrial coating. And then the spiral, this very delicate thing, just the slightest vibration would have made it shift and move. Or who knows, maybe make a sound. This was like, wow, this is radical. Crazy.
Yeah, so 21 is very important. He was looking for a style. He was an untrained artist, so he had to experiment. And he was experimenting first with expressionist portraiture, and then he moved into Dada techniques. At the end of this encounter with Dada, or in the middle of it, in February of 1921, he had to go back to Vienna to take care of a friend of his, a wonderful painter by the name of Józef Nemes Lompiat, who was having a mental crisis. And he ended up spending a month there and reconnecting with the activists with whom he had been associated in Budapest, all these people who formed the Hungarian activist circle around the journal MA. And then he had an encounter in the early fall of 1921 with Béla Uyts, who had just been to the Third International in Moscow, was coming back with an incredible body of documentation of Russian constructivism, absolutely fresh information, theoretical texts, and also images. And Uyts showed this to him. So all this inspired him, I think, intellectually as well, to think about art in a different way. So this really got his wheels turning.
Let's hit the pause button for a moment and take a closer look at Russian constructivism, which was so central to the development of Moholy's artistic work. Russian constructivism emerged in the years around the Russian Revolution of 1917. It was not only interested in making beautiful objects, it asked a much bigger question. What role should art play in a new society? For the constructivists, art was not something that should simply hang on the wall of a museum. Art, they believed, should enter everyday life. It should help build the modern world. They wanted to move away from the idea of the artist as a solitary genius and towards the idea of the artist as a kind of engineer or organizer of visual life. This is why we often see energy, movement in pure construction. The image does not simply represent something, it seems to be actively built. A key idea was that form should serve a purpose. A poster, for example, was not just an artwork, it was a tool of communication. A book was not only something to read, it was something to design, structure, and guide the eye through. At its core, Russian constructivism was driven by the hope that art could participate in social change, artists believed that visual culture could help shape a new collective modern life. Of course, this hope was also tied to the political atmosphere at the end of the Russian Empire and the optimism of the early Soviet Union. So, when we speak about Russian constructivism, we're not simply speaking about a style, we're speaking about an idea that art could help construct society itself.
I think Moholy lost interest in Dada pretty quickly and shifted over to constructivism, which for him held more meaning or was more serious. It wasn't just about shocking people, pushing the limits, but having an agenda behind it.
As we move into 1922, he has an exhibition in February at Der Sturm with Laszlo Pedy, who was an actor, but then decided to become an artist. And this exhibition was revelatory. It was a huge succès de scandale. And then after that, Camille and he started to talk about what the possibilities for art were. And they knew Gabo and Gabo's brother's realistic manifesto, which suggested that art could move into the fourth dimension, which was time, which was movement. And taking some of those ideas and other ideas, they came up with this manifesto, the Dynamic Constructive Energy System. It calls for an art that is completely immersive, participatory, and dematerialized. And out of this emerged, for example, Moholy Nagy's proposal for a leaning spiral tower, which has always been interpreted as a theater. But the more I looked at it, the more I realized this is not a theater. This is more like a play structure for adults. Moholy Nagy felt that adults should also get to know their bodies. He also said, I don't care if you think this is art or not. Of course, he never realized this tower. This was so radical. It was going to be a 12-story high spiral ramp, itself turning on a platform with guardrails, and the middle, further very steep ramps, which basically would have been suicidal, and firemen's poles that you could go down. So it was all kinds of opportunities to have physical, proprioceptive, kinesthetic experiences that expose one to the energies of the world. So this is just one of the series of texts that he wrote and co-wrote in 1922-23. He also went on a vacation with Lucia to her old stomping grounds near Fulda in central Germany, which is where these women's communes were, Loheland, Schwarze Erden. And these were her friends. Moholy Nagy, in the meantime, had also made friends with some of these people. And there, they went hiking, they were eating raw and organic food, and et cetera, et cetera. Long story short, they went to this photo laboratory run by one of the women at the Loheland commune, Bertha Günther was her name. And they discovered her making photographs of plants. And they were fascinated with this. And this is when Moholy Nagy drafted, with Lucia's help, the production-reproduction manifesto, where he was thinking, what the photogram can do is that you can circumvent the camera and you can produce images just with light-sensitive paper and light and with objects.
Moholy embraced it and ran off with it, I would say. He made photograms his entire life. He only lived to the age of 51 and passed away in 1946, but we have photograms from 1946. So from 1922, 1923, up to his death, 1946, Moholy made photograms constantly.
In another article that he published in 1923 on music and sound, Moholy Nagy asked, why can't we just scratch directly into the record and make new sounds that nobody's ever heard before? He tried to do this with an Austrian composer by the name of Hans-Heinz Stuckenschmidt. The results were not that great. And also, he thought, why can't we do this with film? Later on, when sound film came, there was the sound strip. And rather than recording the sounds in the studio, that if we could just scratch the alphabet into the sound strip, we could hear the alphabet. And out of this came this film later on Tonendes ABC, which was recently rediscovered a few years ago. These ideas, they didn't end up being really great works of art always, but they were ideas nevertheless. So his whole approach was to take technologies and rather than have the aesthetics dictated by traditional art, which is what most artists did, even when they took up a new technology like the camera, even avant-garde artists were so rooted in the academic system of a hierarchy of media with painting and sculpture and architecture at the top, and then you move down the hierarchy. Moholy Nagy didn't internalize this hierarchy. He couldn't care less. For him, any medium was just as good as any other medium. That was one thing. The other thing was, because he was untrained, he had to always ask for help. He felt, what I can't do, I can subcontract to experts. Let them do it for me, which also involves this concept that the idea is the most important thing in art. The idea can then be realized through different media with the help of others, technical experts, whatever.
Construction in Emile, his telephone painting. This is probably the most critical. And this is a series of three paintings he did in 1922. And they're porcelain enamel on steel plates. And he had them made by a factory. This is shortly before he went to the Bauhaus in Weimar. They're called the telephone paintings because the story goes he had the paintings laid out on a grid, gridded paper. And he called the porcelain enamel factory, which normally made street signs for naming streets, the numbers on the doors or advertisements that were outdoors. They're called the telephone paintings because Moholy did say it was so easy, I could have done it on the telephone. And then it just turned into like, well, he did him on the telephone. And so he sat it in his studio and he dictated like the game Battleship, where you move your battleship from A5 to C2, etc. So he laid out the composition in a grid. Of course, you can't do diagonals because that would look pixelated or strange. So he kept it very east-west, north-south. The meaning of the work changed. I think when he commissioned a work from the factory, he requested three different sizes. And at first, it was to see the effect, how scale affects color and composition. So that was the idea behind the work. Part of the constructivist ethos was to make paintings as flat as possible, to make the brush strokes disappear. And if you look at a, let's say, a pointillist painting, or you look at a Van Gogh or a Max Liebermann, and you have these heavy brush strokes, there's a modernity there of revealing how a painting is made, of showing the steps of the brush strokes. But the constructivists, they wanted paintings that looked like they were made by the machine, a machine aesthetic. And so there's this logical step to, hey, I'm going to have my next series of paintings made in a factory. That's a great idea. Love it. Modern technology producing a painting. The telephone paintings are this gigantic statement shift in the art world.
His success was astonishing, if you think about it. He came as a penniless refugee in March of 1920 to Berlin, and by February of 1923, he was having a second major exhibition at the most important gallery in Berlin, Der Sturm. It was the second exhibition at Der Sturm with Laszlo Péri. It was in February of 1923, and he showed Nickel Construction mit Spiral, which he showed, I think, at the first Der Sturm exhibition as well. Mainly, I think, he showed the Metal Sculpture. When Gropius saw these and the other works there, I think he was deeply impressed by their newness, by their use of materials, the fact that he used all kinds of materials, including zinc, stainless steel, iron, glass, wood, to lead. I think this stimulated Gropius's imagination as far as teaching students went, because he could see that Moholy Nagy was really interested in the nature of materiality. He knew that Moholy Nagy was being accepted, was an up-and-coming artist. I think when he interviewed Moholy Nagy, he realized that Moholy Nagy knew about the pedagogische Reformbewegung, the new ideas of teaching theory. So even though he had only ever had one private student in his life at that point, a few months earlier, he had this Danish woman, Franziska Clausen. He really had almost no teaching experience whatsoever, certainly not in a classroom situation. I think that Gropius was interested or fascinated by the fact that he knew about all this. Germany was a center of alternative pedagogical approaches in the early 20s and the late teens. And Gropius was immersed in this through the November Gruppe, through the Glass Chain, Gläserne Kette, all of Gropius's involvements. As we know, Lazar Eliseski, the Belarusian artist, would have liked to have this job. And truth be told, Gropius should have given him the job. He was much more accomplished than Moholy-Nagy. He was trained as an architect. He was also an artist. He had worked with Malevich. He had taught in Vitebsk next to Malevich. He was really the originator of international constructivism. He was a brilliant theorist, writer, all that. As brilliant as Moholy-Nagy, if not more, just as brilliant. Different way of thinking about things. But let's not forget, Gropius was replacing someone in this position. He didn't want another rival in the Bauhaus. Leszczynski would have been a rival, or Theo van Doesburg was the other one who wanted to be hired. He even set up his own classes in his studio in Weimar. And, you know, van Doesburg was an accomplished editor by that point, author, theorist, artist. Gropius, I think, felt that he could, in a sense, form Moholy-Nagy to some extent himself, because Moholy-Nagy was a beginner. And also, he intuited, I think, that Moholy-Nagy did not want to be his rival. He wanted to be a team player. This must have been Gropius's intuition. Gropius had enough to contend with. The shift to the right of the government in Thüringen, he was in the middle of one crisis after the other. He didn't want another crisis. Now, he ended up with a crisis because all his colleagues were furious. So his colleagues were like, why did Gropius hire this man who never went to art school, never taught a day in his life in a classroom situation, and had been making art for a few years, seriously, since 1918, that's it. People were upset. So he was taking over from Johannes Itten. We were alluding to Johannes Itten earlier, who was a Swiss artist and teacher, who had been studying in Vienna with Čižek, who was a children's art pedagogue. And so Itten brought a lot of these ideas with him. He had a certain way of teaching, materials, colors. And we know that he took over many of these ideas. So one of the things that people forget was the degree of continuity that there was between the Itten introductory workshop and Moholy-Nagy's introductory course. He didn't want to reinvent the wheel, but Moholy-Nagy was genuinely interested, A, in materials and materiality, but also he was learning in a sense with the students because he had never taken the course like this before or taught one. So the way he taught the course was exploratory and educational for himself as well. And his most talented students built these amazing models, some of which have been reconstructed, and they took this basic idea of experimenting with materials, with light reflecting properties, or light transmission properties, for example, using wire and tensile strength and experimenting with all these things. It was for him an opportunity and for students to learn together. In the end, I think Gropius took a chance and he was incredibly successful.
So Moholy, through his fame, through his art exhibitions at Storm, caught the eyes of Walter Gropius, who was looking to change the direction of the Bauhaus from an art school to more of a design school.
I think that heading the metal workshop made a lot of sense because ultimately I think what Gropius was doing was looking for individuals who shared his vision of what could possibly take place at the Bauhaus in terms of, you know, honing this new idea and this new curriculum of producing not just art, but, you know, encapsulating some overarching ideas, such as breaking away from the previous academic art and design and seeking out a new language. So I think Gropius recognized that Moholy would fit the bill. So it wasn't so important that Moholy have actual metal work
experience, which was probably extremely limited, actually. But what was important is that he was able to come in, hit the ground running, and literally be an extension of Gropius. Ultimately, what we start seeing is this kind of awakening of Moholy's pedagogical work, right? So the Bauhaus curriculum had already fairly been well established by Gropius and the earlier masters. So in terms of Moholy's teaching, I think it starts very slowly. And then what we start seeing is him actually contributing. And we start seeing this kind of foundation for courses being fine-tuned to meet modern needs.
In the end, with Moholy, Walter Gropius appointed a teacher to the Bauhaus staff who was quite different from many of the others. He was not academically trained in the same way as Klee, Kandinsky or Fahninger, and I cannot shake the feeling that this was precisely what made him so invaluable for the Bauhaus. Gropius wanted to lead the school into unknown waters, away from the conventions of the art academies. But how could he truly do that if the Bauhaus continued to rely mainly on academically trained painters? Moholy brought exactly that fresh breeze into the Bauhaus. He had made himself an artist through experimentation. He had tried out different styles, media and materials in order to find his own artistic path. And this was also what Gropius wanted for the students. Not imitation, not academic routine, but active discovery. When Moholy took over the preliminary course, the forecourse, from Johannes Itten, he introduced new techniques and new materials. One of the most famous examples is the photogram. Earlier in this episode, we heard from Oliver Botha that Laszlo and Lucia Moholy first encountered the making of photograms through Bertha Günther at the Lowerland Commune. For those of you who are not familiar with the technique, a photogram is a cameraless photograph. Objects are placed directly onto light-sensitive paper and then exposed to light. When the paper is developed, the covered areas remain light, while the exposed areas turn dark. The result is a kind of negative still life, an image made not by looking through a camera, but by the direct meeting of object, light and surface. And this is important because it shows us something central about Moholy's approach. Photography, for him, was never only about documenting the visible world. It was a field of experimentation. It was a way of asking, what can light do? What can technology do? How can we train the eye to see differently?
As he is in Berlin, he is starting to really actively use the camera. And I think he was really struck by the city lights. And that led to a more mature style that we see that's associated with moving away from constructivism and more towards a new vision. And that ultimately led then to his fairly famous Bauhaus style, where you can clearly see that he's working with shapes and transparencies, and that becomes a central focus. I think it's really important to understand that when Moholy is appointed to the Weimar Bauhaus, it is so to work within the metal workshop. And of course, his wife at this point, Lucia, has already been doing photography for quite some time. In fact, at this point, she kind of picks up an interest. And so it is at the Bauhaus that she starts working with other people, taking her through the basics of photography. And then she really develops a zeal for it. At the same time, Moholy is also starting to do photography on the side, but we have to remember he's doing mostly working in the metal workshop. So that's a very important distinction to make, because we have to be cognizant of the fact that he's not hired as a photographer. So having set that forward, I think what's fascinating is that as they both start delving into photography as a medium, Lucia becomes a far more technically oriented photographer. What I think makes Moholy's photography wholly different, and I think really interesting, is the fact that he's not so concerned about technical capabilities, but it is going back to this concept of playing with transparencies, shape, and light. One of my favorite photographs that he took was in Berlin, and it was done a little bit later. It's shooting a streetscape from the third floor apartment that he was living in, where he basically points the camera out the window, straight down onto the trolley tracks and the streets below. And you have people walking along, casting incredibly long shadows. So it obviously has to be taken in the morning or the late afternoon. And so what he's doing with this is that he's not worried technically what's going on with that. But what he's concerned about is composition, the elements, and again, the interplay of the shapes and the light and the space. I think Lucia ends up developing a very proficient, very technical capability that ultimately contributes to her work in documenting in incredible detail and just absolutely wonderful compositions the entire experience of the Bauhaus, especially Dessau. Whereas Moholy takes a leap and is utilizing photography not for the technical capabilities, but for the artistry.
As with his telephone series, which he had produced in a factory, the creative process seems to have mattered more to him than the final object. In this sense, Lucia and Moholy complemented each other perfectly, the artist and the savvy technician, and this is probably one of the reasons why they continued to work together even after their separation and after their departure from the Bauhaus in 1928 when they both returned to Berlin. If you would like to know more about Lucia Moholy, you should definitely go back in the Bauhaus Faces timeline and look out for the episode about her featuring art historian and Koltort Institute professor Robin Schuldenfrei.
Artists were using cameras, but they were trying to imitate graphic art or impressionist painting. He thought, you know, a camera can be sharp. Why can't we use it to make art that way? A camera can be out of focus. Let's make out of focus pictures. Let's play with the focus. If something is overexposed, that's interesting. Let's play with that. Let's play with different angles. Let's put the camera down on the ground. Let's take pictures from above. Let's have unusual perspectives. It was also a way to help people see the world in a new way. So the camera could help us see the new world in a new way, which could also, in a sense, rewire our brains to adapt to the new world. All these ideas that he was picking up from his environments in Budapest, in Vienna, in Berlin, he wanted to help people experience this new world in a new way. So I think a lot of his theories were about that. And that, of course, at heart, is a pedagogical project. Hatula Moholy-Nagy, his daughter, said to me, he was only secondarily an artist. First and foremost, he was a teacher. Because he wanted to teach art, but he also wanted to teach through art. And he felt that as these new and challenging technologies emerge, in the 20s, it was very challenging for people. Radio was something very shocking for people. Of course, by that time, X-ray technology was already in place. There were experiments with other means of remote imaging. People were experimenting with television. In any case of any challenging technology, he felt that artists had a responsibility to appropriate those technologies, to learn how to use them, and to make art with them in order to humanize them for the general public, and in order that the general public retain control over all these new technologies. And this is why I think that his work and ideas is as relevant now as it was in the 1920s, the 30s, or the 40s. If we want to not be intimidated by technology, we have to learn how to use it ourselves. And it's going to change the way we make art. Photography changed the way people painted. Many of the great 19th century academic painters started to use photography as their method of making sketches. And some of them made beautiful photographs. It didn't kill painting. It changed the way people made art. And this is going to be true into the future as well.
Already in his Bauhaus book, Malerei, Fotografie, Film, Moholy made a very clear argument. Photography and film should no longer be seen as secondary to painting. They were not just technical tools and not just means of documentation. They were artistic media in their own right. And this is where the book becomes especially important. Morley was not only asking what photography and film could show, he was asking how they might transform vision itself. From here, Morley began to imagine polycinema, a cinema that turns film into a spatial experience. And this is where we return to Oliver Botha.
So this idea of the polycinema was that you would have a space, and he never really formulated an absolutely coherent design or plan for it, but he did develop the idea over several texts. Questions he asked is, why do we only show one film at a time on a flat screen? Why don't we show two films at the same time? Or why isn't the film consists of two projections, which could allow for different narrative possibilities? Maybe two lives that come together at a certain point. So you're projecting two films. Or why not three? Why not 12 simultaneous projections of films? And why do we project onto flat surfaces? We can project onto any kind of surface. We can project onto spheres. We could project onto cubes. We could project onto concave, convex surfaces. It would change the way that the image looks. And you could play with those aesthetic possibilities that that new arrangement would afford. Why is the projector stationary? Why can't the projector move around and project within a space all over the place? According to a formula, of course. His idea was that already by the 1920s, people were living in such a sensorially challenging and technologically challenging environment. He wanted to use that complex media environment of modernity as an aesthetic.
He had reached a point in 1928 where he felt painting, this is it. It's all going to shift into photography. He focused on photography and film. Moholy declared painting dead in 1928, only to resume painting in 1930.
By the end of March 1928, several figures crucial to the Bauhaus left the institution together with Walter Gropius. Among them was Laszlo Molinocz, who returned to Berlin, the city where his career as an up-and-coming artist had begun in the early 1920s. He earned his living primarily through typography and stage design. As in other media, Molinocz had formulated clear theoretical aims for typography early on. For him, typography was, above all, a tool of communication. It should primarily create clarity, move dynamically across the page, and incorporate photography as an active element, which he called typophoto. During his Bauhaus years, he put these ideas into practice in some of his most recognizable book designs, using bold circles, lines, arrows, and contrasting font sizes to guide the reader's eye and make content immediately understandable. His work for the stage followed a similar logic. In productions such as The Tales of Hoffmann and The Merchant of Berlin, Moholy transformed the stage into a dynamic spatial machine, using projections, revolving platforms, conveyor belts, and light-reflecting materials to make movement, light, and technology active parts of the performance. This idea would find its most concentrated form in Moholy's Light Prop for an Electric Stage.
Have you seen the photo documents of the stage design for Tales of Hoffmann? If you look at those images and you squint your eyes a little bit, they look like one of his, you know, streetscapes in my mind, just in terms of the incredible shadows, the incredible light play that's taking place. The fact that he can utilize light to highlight certain areas of the stage during different acts and completely change the mood and the feeling of that stage design, which actually remains the same. It's just the lighting that changes. And to me, that is, like you said, it's the red thread. You have that continuous message of let's work with transparency, let's utilize shadows, let's create something novel and that serves the play.
You know, his famous Light Prop for an Electric Stage, dated 1930. He was thinking about seeing theater in a different light, creating a machine that you would project lights onto, you know, like a disco ball that sends lights and stuff everywhere. It's beautiful to look at in a room just by itself, But Moholy at first presented it in a big white box with a circular cutout and colored lights. So you have to imagine the psychedelic, insane light show. It brings the whole room alive. Actually, it's quite logical to take this next step to create this machine that will bring a painting into an entire room, to be able to immerse yourself within light and space.
Originally, the light prop for an electric stage, the so-called light space modulator, I want to underline, he never used that term. I think it's a wonderful title, but it was invented after he died. Most people see it as an early kinetic sculpture, but I actually think that we have to take seriously his own writings about it, and also the fact that he called it the light prop for an electric stage. So it was supposed to be a prop for creating light effects for a play, for a live performance on a stage in a theater, because he was doing all this set design at the time for theater productions. And he was using a lot of projected film and projected light effects and everything in his set designs. This was first shown in Paris in 1930 at this Vagabond exhibition. I think that it was in the box, just like it is in that photograph, with round opening on it, and that it was meant to be a live abstract film. And that round opening was exactly the same size as the round openings through which avant-garde abstract films were to be shown. So he wrote about trying to create a photogram film. This was one of his projects. He really was obsessed with this. And if you have this program of light bulbs inside, which would flash on and off in different times, it was programmed. But even the drawings are very difficult to understand. They're ambiguous. I've never been able to prove this 100%. But I think that it was actually meant to be on. And then you'd see these shadows, a beautiful shadow film behind this translucent glass.
What's interesting, he made also the film Ein Lichtspiel. So he made a machine, and then he made a film of it. And I think the film, that's the finished work.
I think his seminal film is Schwarz-Weiß-Grau. In my mind, at least, that is a culmination of Moholy's obsession with light and also the introduction and partial realization of his vision through moving pictures. He must have been so terribly excited to film it. For people who haven't seen it, it is basically utilizing his light space modulator, which is a machine sculpture that has a perforated disc, spirals made out of chromed metal, working on a series of gears, along with some various pulleys and levers and a wooden ball. The idea is, as you turn the machine on, it starts spinning. And then what you do is you point light at the machine. The interesting part about it is it's not so much about the light bouncing off the machine, but what happens when the light bounces off the machine and casts shadows on the walls. And so this movie, even though it's extremely short, I think it's only like 5 minutes long, you see an opportunity to view the light play that's happening within this space. And it is shot in black and white. And the most fascinating part about it is that ultimately, as you're immersing yourself in this experience of watching this film, you lose sight of where the sculpture physically exists and where the shadows and the reflections begin. And it all becomes kind of a wonderfully, almost cosmic experience of watching light just bouncing around the space within this frame. When we remastered the movie, one of the things we were able to do was find out that one of the things that Moholy always wanted to do, but hadn't been able to do it, maybe perhaps of cost or time or whatnot, but he always wanted to have gamelan music follow along as kind of a soundtrack. When I first read that, I was really taken aback. I was thinking, where would he have heard gamelan music? When would that have come up? And then I listened to gamelan music, and what it is basically very percussive. What you're doing is you're hitting slabs of metal tubes, and they resonate. So it's kind of a very metallic sound. This metallic sound superimposed on these beautiful images of light bouncing within a space really does work perfectly together.
He had kind of a singular idea of transparency and light. And then I think what he was doing is he was applying this concept into different media.
Today, it's normal that artists work in different media. Back then, it wasn't. Feininger was a painter, Klee was a painter, Kandinsky was a painter, and Moholy did painting, filmmaking, photography, stage set design, graphic design, typography. He did kind of everything.
And with this, we come to the end of part one of our podcast episode on Laszlo Moholy Nagy. By now, you may have a sense of just how complex, diverse, and far-reaching Moholy's artistic work was. Of course, there's so much more that could be said. We have not spoken in detail about his photoplastics or about his work as a graphic designer and topographer, both important fields within his oeuvre. But for this episode, I wanted to follow one particular thread: Moholy's intention to mediate between technology and human beings, and the development of his art as an ongoing exploration of light, transparency, and perception across all the media he used. In the second part of this episode, we will meet Daniel and Andreas Haag, as well as Oliver Botha again. Together, we will look more closely at Moholy's work in the UK and at his role as head of the New Bauhaus in Chicago after his immigration to the United States. With the New Bauhaus, Moholy did something crucial. He helped bring Bauhaus ideas to the United States and made them part of an international conversation about art, design, technology, and education. He was not simply someone who had worked at the Bauhaus. He became one of the figures through whom the Bauhaus traveled, changed, and continued beyond Germany. Please also look out for the bonus material. In it, Daniel and Andreas describe some of the most important paintings and sculptures of their grandfather and revisit the evolution from experiment to individual style and beyond. If you enjoyed this episode of Bauhaus Faces, or any other one, I would be very grateful if you could leave the podcast a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It really helps the podcast become more visible and new listeners discover it. And now, there's nothing left to say but tune in next time for a new episode of Bauhaus Faces.